Coming to you live from St. Louis, Missouri.
It's the Faster Freedom Show.
With your hosts, Sam Prim and Lucas Wolf.
We're talking about freedom.
What's going on, everyone? I am Lucas Walls, your host for today. Mr. Sam Prim is again on the beach. Imagine that. But I got an awesome guest in here. Why don't you introduce yourself? Who are you? What's your name?
So I'm John Barbera.
JB is what everybody calls you. You were telling me.
Apparently, yeah.
Well, I like Barbera the Barbarian. Do you ever get that one?
I get the Barbarian a lot.
Yeah.
Back in Texas, it's the Barbarian with everything. Plus, I'm a little rough around the edges sometimes. So
yeah, you kind of are like a Barbarian. Yeah, I love it. So. I think that one goes. We'll get rid of JB and just stick with the Barbarian. But John is up from San Antonio. He wholesales down there and has a coaching business where he teaches others how to wholesale too. So we're going to get into that for the meat and potatoes of our section. It's going to be about acquisitions and wholesaling and what to do with those amazing houses, amazing leads when you get them. Before we get going in the main segment, wanted to mention Freedom Fest. Got to mention Freedom Fest. It's our first in-person event that Faster Freedom will be hosting. It'll be right here in our office, actually through that wall where you presented last night at Buyers Club. So all these speakers have unique gifts, and they run departments of our real estate operation here in St. Louis. So they'll be speaking on what they're experts at, and then we'll have a whole bunch of cool breakout sessions where you guys can dig into your own personal needs, set up a budget, set up a plan for you to go out and create that financial independence for yourself and in hopes to turn that into financial freedom one day. But that is May 9th and 10th, boys? Is that what that is? May 9th and 10th here in our office. We got some cool discount codes. It's not very expensive in general. It's like $398. So to change your life, that's pretty good price. And we got some discount codes floating out there too for a good chunk off. So would love to have you come to St. Louis for those 2 days. It's like a boot camp intensive, and it's going to be a lot of fun and life changing. John, you're obviously welcome to come on up and that'll be a speaker. We can fit you in a book.
Oh yeah.
All right. Well, let's get into the meat and potatoes here. The topic, I kind of like this topic. I don't know. Probably Shano created this back there, but building an empire through acquisitions. That sounds good, right?
Sounds sexy.
Yeah.
I want to learn to do that.
Yeah, there's JB. All right. I mean, the Barbarian. That picture was what, like last year?
Yeah, a few years ago.
Well, John and I met through another mastermind that we're a part of, right. the Inner Wealth Mastermind with Mike Kitko. And we've both gone through some transformations there on the personal level, which obviously helped, you know, translated to growing our businesses and being the best leaders and business owners that we can be. So why don't you tell the audience just a little bit about yourself? You got a super cool story, John, and then we'll kind of dig into the nuts and bolts of wholesaling and how you teach it.
All right. Well, kind of like what I said last night at the talk, people get confused with my accent, and I was born in Argentina.
Yeah.
So I was there until I was 7 years old. So I did kindergarten, first grade. At that point, my dad was sold on the American dream. So we hopped on a plane, flew to New York. He was told that, you know, you'd be walking down the street, trip over $500. That was the American dream. Not once have I ever tripped over $500 on the floor.
What would that look like? What sort of bills would
that
even be?
I mean, it's a roll of cash, yeah. I picture. Some drug dealer just dropped a sack. So we landed in New York, one of the ghettoest towns in Newburgh. It was like off this like really bad street, little studio apartment. I wasn't allowed to go outside because there was always shootings and things going on. Mm. So I spent like a good time just locked up inside. Didn't know English, right? So made fun of a lot because people didn't understand me.
You didn't know English when you were seven and you speak the way you speak now?
Yeah.
That's amazing, man.
Yeah. It's that determination of not being made fun of.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So throughout all that, I was an illegal immigrant. So you need a visa to get to this country from Argentina, but it's a visitor's visa and it's only good for 90 days. So after 20 years of being in this country, I kind of overstayed my welcome a little bit. So I grew up in New York, went to school. After like 11th grade, I just dropped out. There was no point of me staying in school because I couldn't go to college. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't get like a regular job. So I was like, oh, I'm going to work construction or something of the sort. Like, there's nothing else for me. So I did that. So I dropped out of school, started working construction, renovated houses, did all that, got into that. Came across this little Italian guy that was flipping houses, and we were doing all the jobs for him. And we did like so many houses, and he was always coming up. I was like, what, do you own all of these? He's like, yeah. I'm like, how? What are you doing? He's like, well, I'm a real estate investor. I'm like, the fuck is that?
Yeah, so, teach me.
Yeah, what is this? He's like, well, you just buy a house, you fix it up, and you sell it, or you keep it as a rental. I was like, well, no, you buy a house, but I'm fixing it up. So I'm doing all the work, you know? So I was like, then I started getting into like, how do I learn how to do this? Mm-hmm. So the first book I got was Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I don't know if anybody's heard of it. but what that book taught me was that it was possible for somebody like me to build this, because I always thought you needed to come from money. Yeah. You needed to be rich. You needed to come from a status. Like, only rich people own houses, right? That was always my perception. And when I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, I was like, oh, I can do this.
Yeah.
There, here we go. So I started going down that road.
How'd you get your hands on that book?
Actually, Val, my wife, got it for me.
That's amazing.
I actually asked her to get me Donald Trump's Real Estate 101 book, because I was like, who's the biggest real estate investor I know? It was Donald Trump, right, at the time.
What year was this about?
I would say like 2009, okay. 10. Around there?
Yeah, like in the middle of the crash, yeah. Too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So those were fun times. And so she went, and one of her friend's husband told her about Rich Dad, Poor Dad, so she got me both. And she comes with Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and I'm like, the hell is this purple book? You know, like, yeah. It was purple. It was like kind of weird looking. Some Asian guy on the cover.
Paperback?
Yeah.
Yeah, paperback. I had the paperback.
And I was like, what the fuck? I was like, all right. And I looked at the Donald Trump one. I looked at this one, and the letters just looked bigger. And that was the first time I read a book outside of school. Like, I never read. My literacy level was very low. And I was like, well, this one looks easier to read. So I started reading it, and I was like, holy crap. Like, this book is telling me everything that, you know, I need to know about, that I can do this.
Yeah. What do you think your life would be like if you read that other one instead?
You know what's funny? To this day, I've never read it.
No need.
Never read it. I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and it took off from there, and I never opened up that other book.
Yeah, being in the coaching space too, like Rich Dad, Poor Dad, I read it in college, and it changed my life too. Right. But it's, everybody asks, like, what book should I read first? And I just feel so cliche saying that book, but it's so powerful, man.
It covers everything.
Yeah.
It's the thing with it that I like the most is that it's not a book that teaches you how to invest.
No.
It's a mindset book.
For sure.
And that's where, even with my students, I laugh so much, because I thought when I opened up my coaching that it was going to be teaching strategies, you know, sales, negotiations, all these things. I spend 80% of the time talking mindset.
Yeah.
That is the biggest holdup people have is, you know, how can I charge 50 grand for a wholesale?
Yeah.
Right? How can I make this much money? How can I do this? And it's just, it's mindset.
Yeah. And to me, just kind of knowing where you came from, it took you years mm-hmm. to develop that mindset yourself. And I know it did for me too.
Yeah.
So you became a quote unquote expert at the mind. This fly is driving me nuts, by the
it
way.
Wants to be a part of the
That's all right. Come on in. Our third guest, super fly. But, you know, I feel like we're at a point where we're able to give back and teach mm-hmm. that mindset. And I think that's the foundation.
Yeah.
You know, that's more important than the nuts and bolts anyway.
And what's funny is, like, if you're listening, you don't like to hear this, because I know you don't, because you feel that you're broke because you don't have the strategies. And the strategies are everywhere.
Yeah.
You can literally go on any YouTube channel and get all the strategies for free. It's the mindset that's keeping you broke.
Yeah.
It's the fact that you feel like you need to know more. You don't know enough. You don't have enough experience. You need more money. Whatever it is, it's all mindset, because the strategies are literally all over the place.
Yeah.
Right? It's just that you complicate it so much in your head.
Yeah. And Jay Jonesy said, Rich Dad, Poor Dad is goated. And it's a great book. And I love the story that he tells throughout the book too. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting to me is my dad gave me that book. Oh. And, you know, it's funny because my dad has some qualities of both, mm-hmm. and I can kind of see it in the book. So, but I'm forever grateful and in debt to him for giving me that book. Like, hey, you should read this. I was like, read a book
yeah.
in college? why? What would I need that for? I'm reading all these engineering books. So it was a huge turning point in my life.
Yeah, very powerful book. Yeah, no, my dad, I don't think my dad ever read a book. He was also like just working. The only thing he ever taught me was work ethic.
Yeah.
Not the only thing, but the biggest thing he taught me was work ethic.
Yeah.
Like I've never seen anybody work as hard as him.
Yeah, that's important too, man.
So that's why like I always, when people say like, how are you going to do this? I was like, look, all I can promise you is nobody's going to ever outwork me. Like, you're not going to take my food. Yep. That's for damn sure.
No, I love it, man. So your wife gives that book, you read it. What happens after that?
So what happened after that is I've read that one. I read down, like I started going down that whole track. I got a wholesaling book because at the time I still didn't know about wholesaling.
Yeah.
So I felt like, you still need to buy houses. And I bought this other book actually from Kiyosaki. It's called like The Big Book of Real Estate or something. It's not a popular book, but it covers everything having to do with real estate. It had commercial real estate, multifamily, land, everything. And in there, it had a section about wholesaling. And it was like, here's wholesaling. You don't need any money and you can make a lot of money. I was like, great, because I don't have any money and I need a lot of money. Yeah. So it made sense. And the guy teaching that segment was Dean Graziosi.
Yeah.
So I picked up his books on wholesaling and I was like, here we go. I got his books. I know how to do marketing now. I know how to do all this. And that's how people teach you. They teach you to start with marketing. So he teaches a strategy. It's a 25-1. So you go on the MLS, you make 25 lowball offers, 50% from whatever they're asking, and to get hopefully one contract out of that. So I burned out a shit ton of realtors, pissed off so many people, but I got a property on the contract.
Yeah.
I got it for $44,000.
It was listed for 88?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. You kind of fudge the numbers a little, so it's not like...
Exactly.
They're like, oh, you just did 50%, right? So it was like, I think like 78 something, and I just went at 44, and they accepted it. And then I was like, now what?
Yeah.
I don't know what to do. So I went out, this was 12 years ago, 13 years ago, so I went on Craigslist, because there wasn't like the Facebook groups you have now. The RIA at the time was like 50 minutes away, and it was only like just real estate agents there. So I went on Craigslist, I put the property, one guy responded, and I was like, all right. And he's like, yeah, I'll go see the house. He flaked on me, didn't show up. I panicked, and I just canceled the contract.
Oh, man.
So that was it. Less than a month later, that house sold on the MLS for the full asking price.
Yeah.
So I was like, man, I could have wholesaled this for like 70 grand.
Yeah.
And made a killing.
Yeah.
But I think that was intentional for me not to make that easy money. Because everybody I've seen that gets started in real estate that makes easy money, they struggle.
Yeah.
Because then they keep looking for easy money. And you and I know, like, this is anything but easy when you're starting off.
For
you gotta
sure.
be willing to put in the work.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think it's the best place to start in real estate investing, wholesaling. But we went so backwards in our journey. We did a rental first, then a fix and flip, and then we took down a fix and flip that was pretty clean, and we actually closed on it. But then we pretty much just sold it after we closed on it without touching it, and made 20 grand, didn't touch it. And we're like, well, and then we went to, Than Merrill, remember Than Merrill?
Yeah, we
went to one of his events here in St. Louis.
Fortune Builders.
Yeah, and they were preaching wholesaling hard and tried to hard close us on another $20,000 product. And it was a pretty terrible experience, honestly. Yeah. But he talked about wholesaling a lot in there, and that just put the terminology to what I was starting to already put together. So we went completely backwards. So we're going to talk about the right way to do things and kind of the right steps to get towards that financial independence today.
Yeah, but that's why I love wholesaling, because it teaches you marketing, teaches you sales, it teaches you about the market, what's working, what's not. You know, when a lot of people, they want to start with flipping because I get it, it's sexy. That, you know, they say, well, you can make a lot of money with flipping. You can make a lot of money with anything that you're good at. It doesn't matter what it is. It's just that flipping is sexy. So they start with that. And then, yeah, I lost my ass on this. And I'm like, what a shocker. You bought in the wrong area, over-improved, hired the wrong contractors, took too long.
Yeah.
And now you're underwater on the deal, you know? And I see that so many times.
Yeah.
And it's like when you start with wholesaling, you get to learn who the investors are, what strategies are working, what part of the market people flip, what part of the market people hold houses, what part of, in San Antonio is a lot of owner finance, what section of the market they're doing owner finance. You get such a massive understanding of the market in such a short period of time.
Yeah.
You know, flipping, it will take you forever to get that. Mm-hmm. And in a year of wholesaling, you can understand, like, I know all of St. Louis, or I know all of San Antonio.
Yeah.
So
to stay on a similar theme there on, like, where to get started in real estate investing, whether, you know, a lot of people, you know, building wealth and rentals, like, long-term play, like, that's a lot of people's goals, mm-hmm. I would say. But I always like starting in either wholesaling or fix and flipping and getting a few deals under your belt, regardless if you got a good income or not, right? So kind of a couple funnels, and I want to get your feedback on this, mm-hmm. that I talk to people, because, and I want you to, like, pick holes in this for me. But what I tell students is, I almost put it in like a personality funnel, okay. Like where, like, wholesalers more sales and marketing focused, mm-hmm. in personality and skill sets, and then fix and flippers, especially if you got the credit and income from like a W-2 job, if you're like an engineer, finance and operations type, maybe fix and flipping is the best place to start for you versus wholesaling. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that's a very deep way of looking at it, and it makes sense. I look at it with my business partner, John Barr. So he is the fix and flip person.
Yeah.
He is more analytical. He is more about the numbers. He hates the people, yeah. You know, that whole marketing. I'm great with the marketing and the people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So I always gravitated towards that because it was easy for me, you know, and he always gravitated towards the fix and flip.
Yeah.
That being said, sometimes if you can't find a partner, you know, like, you got to suck it up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you may not like wholesaling, but you can do it.
Yeah,
you
understand? For sure.
You can still get it done.
Yeah.
You're not probably going to be a superstar wholesaler, yeah. but you'll do enough. You'll do well enough to get your own deals,
yeah.
to get your own stuff going. But yeah, I think wholesaling is definitely, I've met some people that I have told them, I was like, look, either get a partner or go get a job, because, like, you're terrible. Like, you're just bad at this. You know, they have terrible personality. They yeah. get offended quickly. You know, they curse out sellers, or they don't have the patience. I'm like, bro, you're just going to keep struggling.
Yeah.
Like, either get a partner that can do this or just do something else. This yeah. is not for you.
Yeah, I like that. I think it all comes down to, you know, knowing your market, learning how to analyze a deal, and creating deal flow. Whether you're a fixer flipper or a wholesaler, you got to have some sort of acquisitions funnel, mm-hmm. of some sort. All right, so getting back to your journey a little bit, mm-hmm. and we'll so you canceled that contract, and then what did it look like as far as your education and some tactful things you did to go into your first real estate investment deal after that first deal you canceled?
So after that first deal I canceled, it took me 3 years.
Oh man!
Before I got my next deal, I was in New York at the time.
So still in New York.
And yeah, well, and that's when I was like, all right, New York sucks, right? It's not business friendly. It's a blue state. It's just, we have a company. My brother had a company, a construction company, and we, you know, you wouldn't keep the majority of the profit you made, right? Because it was workers' comp, insurances, all this shit. It was like 60-70%
yeah.
was going to the government right off the bat, right? So it was very difficult. And then at the time, real estate, because of the financial crisis, the banks had a lot of ghost inventory, which they just had, they were holding on to houses that were vacant, but they didn't want to release them into the market because they didn't want home prices to drop. So there was these vacant houses that were just deteriorating, and the banks were not selling them. They were just not letting them go. And so what happens is home prices were really high, rents were really low, taxes were really high. So it's like, it was a terrible investment market.
Yeah.
You could not rent, you know, you weren't cash flowing on anything.
No.
So I was like, all right, I gotta get out of New York. So I started doing some research. I was like, what state survived the financial crisis? And I saw Texas. Mm. And I was like, well, Texas is cool. Like,
yeah.
they have that kind of attitude of, like, yeah. you know, come and take it kind of thing. So I was like, I like that. And I looked at Dallas, Austin, and San Antonio. And when I did the market research for each one, I saw, like, Dallas and Austin were very hot, very competitive.
Yeah.
And I saw San Antonio was, like, kind of lukewarm. And I was like, well, you know, my logic was it's going to eventually gravitate, right?
Yeah.
Like, people are going to go to San Antonio because it's affordable. So we packed up the car, moved down to Texas, landed in San Antonio, and that's when I started like networking again, working with people, and I was trying to do it on my own. I had that ego of like, you know, I can do this. I read this book, and this hillbilly from like Idaho was killing it. Yeah. You know, I'm like, I'm smarter than him. I can do this. And no offense to anybody from Idaho. It
was or just, any hillbillies.
Or any hillbillies. Yeah. You guys are awesome. but that's how, that was my ego, right? It was my ego saying, like, I'm better. I can do this. And I spent over a year in Texas, and it was like nothing. I was losing out every single contract I would put out. No offers were getting accepted. And I just, out of just desperation, I put out a post on one of the forums in San Antonio, and I was like, hey, boots on the ground here. I speak Spanish. I know construction. I'm willing to work for whatever. Like I want to learn real estate. Who can help? And then this investor's out of Austin. They're like, hey, we need boots on the ground in San Antonio. And I was like, yeah, as long as you're willing to teach me. They're like, yeah, we'll give you 20% of whatever we make. I was like, shit, cool. Yeah. That even works, right? Yeah. I wasn't even expecting to get paid. So they started teaching me. And one of the mistakes I was making, and this is why I say contractors are terrible investors, is because as a contractor, I would go into a house and be like, it needs new trim, new doors, new cabinets, new everything. But as an investor, it's like, no, we're just going to paint that. Yeah. We're going to keep this. You know, in this area, it doesn't make sense. So that's why I wasn't getting any offers accepted. I was looking at it as a contractor.
Just overestimating your rehab.
Greatly. I mean, all my budgets were like redoing the whole house.
Yeah.
Right? And when you look at it as an investor, it's like, what do the comps say?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. You know, nobody was teaching me that.
Yeah.
That's like you when you renovate, when you do anything, you look at what the comps are, and that's what you do.
Yeah.
So that's, I didn't know. And then the investor taught me how to like look at a property that way. And I was like, then I started like reflecting back on all the deals. I was like, yeah, I love bought the shit out of everybody.
Imagine if you got one though.
No, what?
Yeah,
no
it'd be deep.
Yeah, oh, it would have been a home run at that point. But yeah, I didn't get any of those times.
Yeah.
And I started working with them, and they taught me everything about like foreclosure marketing because it was big at that time in San Antonio. Subject twos, that's the primary what we did with foreclosures are great for sub twos, right? Because you can reinstate the loan, take over the financing.
Yeah.
So we started doing all that, and they were kind of screwing me on my 20%. What they would do is like they would wholesale a deal. Then they would take out all of their expenses, all of their people, all of their stuff. And then what was left, they'll give me like a $300 check. And I'm like, but we wholesaled this for like 20.
Yeah.
Like, how am I getting 300? Well, we have expenses here and there. I was like, it's cool, man. Just teach me, you know? And funny enough, karma, whatever, I'm in business. They're not.
Yeah.
You know, and the table kind of goes around. And but I learned everything about, you know, subject to closing deals, contracting, analyzing deals. So it really prepared me to go off on my own.
Yeah, that's great. We talk about, what was your role there? What would you, like job title?
I guess, like lead manager, acquisition manager kind of thing.
Yeah, and we talk about like ways to go full-time and steps to go full-time because that's a big thing, right? And I love it. Because it's what I did, and I'm passionate about making real estate not only a good investment, but a business. So one of the main options that Brian Schroeder has done, is take a job within the real estate or real estate investing industry with a reputable company, so you can learn the ropes. You can learn so much in a short period of time than. So much more than you would be just, you know, watching podcasts and reading books. Just the education is supercharged. So that's really cool that you did that.
Yeah, and I think what matters is like when I got started, what was different is you didn't have the amount of options you have now to like take a job with somebody, and that but you do now, right? And you also didn't have the amount of education that you do now. So where I think the advantage for me was is that I wasn't overloaded with information. Where I see people nowadays is they have too many options and it becomes overwhelming and they don't know which way to go.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, this guy's preaching this and this guy's preaching that and this guy's doing this and this guy swears by that. And I'm like, yeah, you kind of got to just jump in, you know, because like they're all right because if it works for them, it works for them.
Yep.
They're right.
Doesn't mean it's right for you, though.
Exactly. The thing is, like, you got to figure out, what do you want to do?
Yeah. And I think that all starts with marketing and acquisitions and getting the deal. And then you have all of those options at your fingertips.
Yeah. And that's why, like, I learned that, you know, that if you can generate your own deals, your chances of screwing up, you know, go down tremendously. Yeah. Because it's like you have so much margin.
Yeah.
At that point, that's like, what do you want to do? Do you want to wholesale it? Do you want to flip it? Do you want to keep it? Yep. What do you want to do?
Subject to it?
Yeah. I mean, there's a million things you can do now because you negotiated such a great deal.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, that's why it's definitely that path is the one I definitely recommend to everybody.
Very cool. So took that job and then, you know, learned a lot and then decided to go out on your own at some point, right?
Yeah, I mean, at some point I was like, all right, I've learned and you guys keep screwing me over. I need to make money.
Yeah.
You know, I was with them for about a year and I learned a ton. And at that point, we were actually at a networking event and I met John Barr. And we met at a networking event in Austin. He's like, oh, I'm in San Antonio. I was like, well, so am I. Like, let's get together for coffee. And he's telling me, like, pretty much, he's like, I like the whole back end of real estate, like doing with title. You know, doing all that back end stuff, all that. And I was like, great, because I hate it.
Yeah.
But I'm good at the front end. I like talking to sellers, negotiating, getting contracts. And I was like, how about we just work together? He's like, let's do it.
Yeah.
And we partnered up at that point. And yeah, we've been partners for like 8 years, 9 years now.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And yeah, I would lock him up. He would take him down and we just rinse and repeat. And we were just doing it that way. Nice.
Tell us about your very first deal together. Do you remember that one?
Ooh, the very first deal. It's been, I've done a lot of deals, brother. I really can't. I don't know if I could. Oh, so I'm terrible with contracts. Like, I hate contracts. I hate paperwork. I don't go to doctors just because they ask me to fill out paperwork. And the very first deal.
And you're a barbarian.
Yeah, and I'm a barbarian, yes.
They don't need
doctors. I just smash shit. Yeah. I'm like, fuck this. So I go to this property. We found it also on a foreclosure list, and I'm good at talking to sellers. So I spoke to her. I solved all her problems. She was so excited and everything. And I'm like, I gotta get her on the contract. I'm like, fuck. And I take out the contract, and it's a standard Texas contract. It's called the Trek, and it's like at the time it was 9 pages. Now I think it's like 11 or 12, and it was 9-page contract. I'm like, okay. So I sit down with the lady. I'm looking at her. I was like, well, you want to initial down here, flip the page, initial down here, flip the page, initial down here. So she initial every page. On this page, you want to sign? She signed. The whole contract was blank. She just initial and signed the whole contract. And I was like, all right, so I'll get this over to title. And, you know, and I'll let you know as soon as everything's ready. She's like, oh my God, thank you so much.
And you verbally agreed to a price.
We verbally agreed to, like, that I was gonna take over the payments.
Okay.
And we were gonna give her like $5,000.
This is a sub-2 deal.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we were gonna give her the $5,000 that she was gonna be able to walk away. That's what she needed to be able to move and all that. So I was like, yeah, well, you know, you're gonna do all that. Then I get to the office, I give the contract to John, and he's like, dude, this is blank. Yeah. I was like, okay, so here are the terms.
write it down.
Yeah, I don't know where it goes. I was like, but here are the terms. Here's what we agreed to. He's like, you're fucking terrible.
Yeah.
But the thing is that because I got away with that and it worked, I kept doing that. And I never learned how to, like, really fill out a contract until, like, years later. I kept doing, like, blank contracts. And people, I'll just write down, like, my company name, their name, maybe a sell price, and then just initial sign.
Yeah.
And that was about
it. Keep
it
simple.
That's it. Yeah. So when people get overwhelmed with contracts, I was like, they're like, oh, yeah, I think I lost them at the contract. I'm like, no, you lost it at the beginning.
Yeah.
They didn't trust you. They didn't like you. They didn't feel like you can solve their problem.
Yeah.
Right? So that's why the contract was so difficult for you. But I kind of proved that contracts don't matter if you solve their problems.
For sure. Love that. So one of your first deals was a sub-2 deal. Do you still own that house to this day?
I didn't own any of those houses. I always regret it. Right? Like, you look back.
So you wholesaled the sub-2 deal?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, wholesaled. Keep in mind, like, I came from being, like, flat broke.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like,
you weren't even thinking about generational wealth and equity at this time.
I was thinking survival.
Yeah.
Like, I needed to make enough money to feed my family.
Yeah.
Like, that was it. And at the time, it was, like, $2,700 a month. So that's what I needed to make just so we could survive. So, and it was a struggle to make $2,700 a month. Like, 'cause
especially with $200 paychecks from your old company.
Oh, man. Yeah, with them, I was not, at the time, my wife was working as an occupational therapist, so she was floating the bills.
Yeah.
But it was, she got pregnant with my firstborn, Nico, and I had promised her that she was going to be able to be home with the with our kid, and she wasn't going to need to work anymore. And my son was born in August. So in July, I was still not making $2,700 a month. So I was like, fuck it. I made her a promise and I'm going to stick to it. I'm sitting on my, man, I still remember this. I was sitting in my bed with my laptop applying at Home Depot.
Oh, man.
And yeah, I even feel it, you know, like.
No way they called you.
No, dude, I didn't get through the application. It was like 2.5 hours. I was like, holy shit. But like 15 minutes in, like I feel my body like just overheating.
Yeah.
I was getting so angry. I was getting so pissed. I felt so defeated.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like I was letting my family down, my wife down.
And this was after you and John were already decided to be partners?
Yeah. This is when we were like, yeah, we had just started. Yeah. And it just got to a point where I was like, I'm like 20 minutes into this, and they tell you it's like a 2.5 hour application. I was like, holy shit. But my logic was like, all right, I'll go work at Home Depot. I'll rub elbows with contractors, flippers, people like that. Maybe I can strike up some deals or something that way. That was my thought process. And I already knew Home Depot. I mean, I lived at Home Depot. So I was like, I know more than most of the people that work there anyway.
You just show up one day with an apron on.
I know all the aisles are, where all the material is.
Yeah, aisle 12.
Yeah, aisle 12. I used to do that. Like, we did so many jobs that when people were like, where do you find this? Oh, that's 13 down towards the back, though. So I'm doing the application, and it got to a point where I almost got nauseated filling it out. And I just shut the computer. I was like, F this.
Yeah.
I'm going to make this shit work. And I don't know what switched, but from that moment on, I always made what I needed to make.
Yeah.
I've been doing it for 3 years, nothing. From 1 month to another, I started making money.
That's amazing.
I was like, that's why when people say, you know, mindset, I was like, no, it matters.
Yeah.
It matters when you shift that. Like the universe just said, all right, let me move out of your way and let's start doing that. And every month, it was a struggle. Don't get me wrong. There were times that it was like a week before the end of the month, and I'm like, oh, fuck, I don't know how I'm going to eat this week. You know, like, and then all of a sudden a deal will come through and we get paid. Yeah. And it was like $3,000. Hey,
we're good.
Yeah.
We're good for a month.
Another month. Let's go.
Man, I just think there's so many good lessons in having to go through that and just like having to budget and live below your means. Mm-hmm. And then when you actually do get some discretionary income, you understand that you can't just go blow it all.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of lessons. I remember some of the times just getting started and going full time and wanting my wife to be a stay at home mom. And I went through that a lot. Looking back on it, it's a lot of fun. Honestly, it sucked being in the middle of it, but man, it created a lot of great life lessons for me.
Well, to me, I think what the issue I came across is that I've always struggled as an immigrant. You're kind of used to doing like the shit work, right? And I'm fine with that. I never had an issue with it. I'm fine with like barely getting by. I've always spent that. But when all of a sudden my wife is expecting our first child, it's like it became real.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, no, fuck this. No.
Can't.
This is not acceptable. Yeah. My son is not going to see that life that I saw.
Nico. Shout out to Nico, by the way. What a sweet name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, my second born is Lucas.
Even better name. Yeah.
So, that was before I met you. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't take credit for that.
No, it wasn't. You didn't impact my life that much.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, man. Let's go. So, let's go back a little more tactical before we keep going on with your journey. So, that sub-2 deal that you were talking about with not filling out the contract and giving it to John, that was after the Home Depot application, I assume, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Talk about what it looks like to wholesale a sub-2 deal.
So here's where I don't know
even what a sub-2 deal is. Start there.
I don't have any problems. Like, I'd never met the guy, Pace Morby.
Yeah.
But what sometimes it rubs me wrong when somebody is preaching sub-2s.
Yeah.
And I'm like, they're dangerous.
Yeah.
They're dangerous deals because if you don't paper them up correctly, if you don't do them right correctly, you can really screw over the seller. And I think as wholesalers, as investors, we have tremendous power because we are speaking to somebody at their most vulnerable,
mm-hmm.
that they're willing to do anything to avoid, you know, foreclosure or something terrible to happen to them. And we can take complete advantage of that, right? So what a sub two is pretty much the way we did it, is they're in foreclosure because they owe payments on their bank. They haven't been making payments. So they're behind, they're in arrears. What we can do is catch up those payments, make that loan current, and then we take over that loan. So we're buying the house subject to the existing financing,
mm-hmm.
right? So we're taking over that loan. We keep making the payments, those mortgage payments moving forward, but we take deed to the property, right? So the property is now ours.
Mm-hmm.
But the loan stays in the seller's name.
Yeah.
Right? That's where it gets dangerous. So a lot of people, what they don't do is they don't give the seller an option to foreclose. So if I don't give a seller the option to foreclose, if I default on it, they have no recourse.
Yeah.
They have a loan to a house they don't own.
Yeah.
So they have nothing. They essentially have a loan now,
yeah.
for no collateral, right? So a lot of people, what they do is they do that, is they buy sub two and they don't give the seller a recourse to take the home back if you start missing payments, mm-hmm. right? So it's a terrible strategy if you do it that way. And then the next thing that you have to be very careful with is who you wholesale it to.
Right.
So I typically don't encourage people to wholesale sub twos. I tell them, buy them for yourself. I agree with that all day long.
Yeah.
But wholesaling them, who are you wholesaling it to?
Yeah.
Do they have the means? What if the loan gets called due? Can they take care of that? Right? I know that there are a lot of strategies to... when they get called due for you to kind of like bypass that. But if they don't know those strategies, if you're not involved anymore, then what happens? Does the seller get screwed again? Right? Like what's going to happen in this whole situation? So whenever we wholesale this up too, it was always to investors that were very experienced. They had the means. They just rather buy it sub two because it made more sense,
yeah.
right? Instead of just paying it out, right, and having almost no equity.
Yeah.
Let me take over the payments. It has a little bit of equity, but it cash flows really nicely because the loan with sub twos, one of the things that it's not just a sub two deal. It's the age of the loan that matters.
Yeah.
If the loan is 10 plus years old, it's a much more attractive deal.
For sure.
Even if it's almost no equity, but at that point, you're paying a lot less interest and more principal.
Yeah.
So the equity buildup gets tremendous mm-hmm. at that point. Every year that goes by, you're building more and more equity.
And better chance at equity with a 10-year-old loan.
Yes,
yeah.
100%. So I like, you know, you got to look at all those things when you're looking at a sub two. But when we structure sub twos and we wholesale them, it was always to the same three investors that mm-hmm. we knew that we can trust. They had a lot of means. They were good people. They were very, you know, pillars of the community. They weren't going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
Right. And we were very cautious with how we did it, you know, but yeah.
So you gave the seller, you know, you're out of pocket, let's say $5,000, mm-hmm. catch up some payments, give them some money to move the seller, and then say you wholesale it for $25,000. So the in buyer, one of those three people that you're talking about, pillars of the community, come to the table with $25,000, and then they start making the payments, correct?
Yeah.
And then you get 25 minus 5, you get a $20,000 wholesale fee pretty much.
Well, no, so the buyer buys everything. So the wholesale fee includes, so let's say I wanted to make $25,000 in that deal, but there's also $5,000 reinstatement.
Yeah.
And there's closing costs and whatever. So my wholesale fee to them is gonna be $30,000.
Gotcha, yeah.
Right, because then the $30,000 has my wholesale fee plus the reinstatement amount and all that.
Nice.
And that was acceptable. That's kind of what's expected. Is that's why whenever we send a deal, a sub two deal to somebody, we tell them, here's the reinstatement, here's what the PITI is gonna be, here's what you're pretty much taking over.
Yeah,
right?
No, I love that. Super cool strategy, especially nowadays.
Oh,
you know?
Nowadays, yeah, with the interest rates being what they are.
Yeah, where the BRRRR is not dead, but pretty damn close. Yeah.
Well, a lot, and especially in San Antonio. In San Antonio, we had home prices like really shoot up.
Yeah.
And so you had home prices shoot up, interest rates shoot up, insurance shoot up. taxes go up and rents are still kind of low
because
they take a while to catch up.
Yep.
So people are needing to leave like $50,000-$60,000 on a property just for it to cash flow.
Yeah. It's pretty similar here, but it's more like $20,000 in here, but still it has to happen. You got to be at, like you said last night when you were talking, got to be almost at that 60-65% LTV to get the cash flow that a normal deal 2 years ago at 80% LTV would get.
And that's why buyers weren't getting a lot of wholesale deals, buy and hold buyers, because it's like, I got to wholesale it to you at like 65 for it to make sense to you, but I can wholesale it to a fix and flipper for 80%.
Yeah.
You know, because it completely flipped. I'm have flippers.
Because that still works.
Yeah. Because at 80%, like, that's where the, also, I didn't get to, there's so many things I wish I would have been able to cover yesterday, but like the 70% rule. People talk about, oh, the 70%, the 80% rule. I'm like, after 250 grand ARV, the 70% rule almost doesn't matter anymore.
Especially to flippers.
Exactly.
Especially.
You got to run your numbers.
Yep.
So what are my costs?
Yep.
Am I listing it? Do I have an agent that's listing it? What are the fees? What are the closing costs?
Yeah.
What is all that? Because after that, maybe I've done $350,000 home that are 84% deals.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Because I was still netting 35 grand because it was a quick in and out deal.
Yeah, we run our numbers very similar. Our like kind of floor for the normal 75% rule is a little higher than yours. It's that 400 is where we run it, and then we start to run an ROI formula, and we want to make 10% on whatever our total investment is.
Right.
And so if we're into it for 400, we want to make 40K on a house. So and if we're going to make 40K on a house using the discount percentage method, we'd probably be at 85%, give or take. So that model definitely has changed for us, and it's been fun because we've been able to get a lot of big chunks of profit on those $400,000-$600,000 houses that we would have passed on, you know, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, no, and even that, like, you know, when we factor in our repairs, what we're getting to now because we source our own deals is I want at least one-to-one return for the repair to profit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So if I'm putting 30 grand, I will better be making at least 30 grand, if not more.
Yeah.
Right? So, and especially when it goes higher. But once it crosses like 70 grand, I want to be making closer to 90. Because at those levels in San Antonio, when you're renovating that much, there's more things that can go wrong.
Yep.
There's more, it could take longer.
Yep.
Things can shift more. So I want to create a better buffer.
Yeah.
Because I'm generating my own deals. I don't need to do marginal deals anymore.
No, I love that. I like looking at it that way. So let's get back to your journey a little bit. Home Depot application, what year was that?
So my son is 8 years old.
So 2016-ish?
So, yeah. 2015.
Oh, so 15, 16. Yeah, Home Depot application, you have a mindset shift. Talk through me the next 2-3 years on what that looks like after you had that mindset shift.
So the next 2-3 years, it was I started developing what is known as stress. So I started going. I didn't stop. I was waking up at 5 a.m., going to sleep at like 1 a.m. nonstop. Just anything I could do, anything and everything. You know, I was not letting my family down. And we were doing all kinds of marketing. I mean, cold calling, door knocking, driving for dollars, calling every list, you know, foreclosures, just anything that would stick. We started doing flips.
Yeah.
So we were rehabbing houses. The first flip, I fired the contractor not even halfway through. So we had to go in, buy some tools and finish the flip ourselves. The second flip, fired the contractor 2/3 of the way through. We had to go finish that one. The fourth flip, we fired the contractor 3/4 of the way through.
Improvement.
So we were improving on each flip and learning how to manage these contractors. You know, everybody's after 2008, everybody became a GC. You had a drill and a hammer, you were a GC, even if you were a painter.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody was a GC. So it's like sourcing, you know, finding the right contractors, working with contractors, doing the work. Like, it was definitely a huge learning curve for us. So we started flipping houses. It was going a little bit better. We were making ends meet. But the problem was, like, we would get a deal. We would get two deals. Everything's going great. We would sell those. And then we're like, oh, shoot, we don't have anything else right now. Right? So it's back to, we need more deals.
Yeah.
So that was a mistake that we made. No, nobody taught me that. It's like, never stop marketing.
Yeah.
right? Like, we would get a deal and we would stop, and we would focus only on that deal and get that deal done. The materials, go to Home Depot, go to Floor and Decor, match out the tiles, you know, all the pretty shit you see, right? And then we finish the project and we're like, now what? Okay, hit the streets again and start marketing again. And there's always a lag time, right?
Especially if you're flipping.
If you're flipping. I have students right now that they're like, yo, I had an amazing February, you know, that killed it in February. And I was like, don't relax.
Yeah.
Because the reason you killed in February is the work that you did in October, November, December.
For sure.
You understand? Like, this isn't that you did something in February and killed in February.
Yep.
You know, so if you stop now, by the time you hit April, you're going to realize you have no deals. And by the time you start, it's going to be August before you hit your next deal. So your lull goes to like 6 months of nothing. And that's what we would experience.
Yeah.
So we would experience 4, 5, 6 deals at once. And then nothing for like 8 months. So it was nothing but stress, you know? And it was like, where do we get this? And we were talking to this person, but the lead time is so long before we close the deal. So it was extremely stressful. It was just a very stressful time. Then we figured like, all right, we're good with flips. Like we're eating, right? We're surviving. Let's just build some houses. Why the fuck not, right?
Yeah.
Let's just complicate our
like
lives.
Like new construction?
Yeah, new construction. So we got some lots. We started building some houses. Nightmare.
Yeah.
Complete nightmare. So five of the houses that we were, well, there were three new builds and two like complete remodels that we were tearing down and rebuilding pretty much. Those just, we finally wrapped them up last year, finally wrapped up the deals. It's been like 5 years that we were working on them. And to settle at a loss of $250,000.
Oh boy.
Not a profit loss, like a loss out of our pocket of $250,000.
Mm.
So those were some bad, bad deals that we got into just because we wanted to try new construction.
Yeah, did selling those feel good still in a way, even though you lost a butt ton of money?
It got to the point that it had been so long that I just didn't care.
Yeah.
I honestly, like, John calls me. He's like, all right, we sold the last one. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
Like, I was.
Get rid of it.
It was nights of not sleeping.
Yeah.
It was stress. It was sometimes issues between Bar and I because we were both so stressed out about them. So it was a very hectic situation, you know, to be a part of.
Yeah.
And luckily we kept the flips that kept bringing us our daily bread, pretty much, we never stopped those.
Yeah.
So even though we took $250,000 hit, it was like, all right, that sucked.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like, shit, we're out of business.
Yeah.
Right? It was just more of like, man, I wish that wouldn't have happened, but we're okay.
Yeah.
We're fine. We've still been generating deals and all that. But during the time of just dealing with the stress and not knowing what the hell is going to happen and how is it going to shake out? We use private funds for all the deals that we do. We don't use like hard money. So it was private investors involved in this. And it's like, they love us. But at that time, I was like, oh, God, I don't know what we're going to do.
Yeah, I know we said 9 months, but what about 5 years, guys?
Yeah.
You guys good with that?
Does that work for you? But luckily, the investors, they've been with us for so long that they cut us some grace and, you know, that's where the $250,000 loss is to the investors.
Yeah.
Like the house has still made some money, but not enough to cover all the interest, you know? So, but if you trust us, we make you whole.
Right.
Right.
Same.
So even though like their initial investment was protected, but their interest was lost. So we made sure to pay them all the interest that they actually generate, you know, so the investors still walked away fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, we took a nice.
Quite the hit.
Kick in the teeth.
Yeah, for sure. So you have 3 years at least of just grinding, grinding. And then you get to 2019, 2020. What's the point where things kind of, you know, started to click a little bit for you guys?
So in 2020, you know, I don't know if you guys heard, but there's a pandemic.
Yeah, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, it was in the news somewhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's when real estate blew up in Texas.
Yeah.
And it was funny because the shutdown happened in March. It literally happened the day right after we closed on a big house that was a very speculative
deal. On a purchase?
Deal. Yeah, that we bought ourselves. And it was kind of like a speculative deal. It's not our typical bread and butter. And we close on it. The next day, there's a shutdown. We're like, I called John. I was like, can they take it back?
Yeah.
And they're like, no, it's done. I was like, oh, crap. Mm-hmm. So I was like, all right, we have a motto that's like the only way out is through. Yeah. So we just, you know, well, let's get it done. We didn't know that the real estate market was going to do what it did.
I don't think anybody did.
Oh, man, we killed it on that house.
Yeah, good.
Like, we were so scared of like, maybe we'll make 20, and it's like we made like 70.
Good.
You know?
Good for you guys.
Yeah, so, but the thing to keep in mind is like that was just luck.
Yeah.
You know, that wasn't strategy. That was pure luck. It played that way, and it didn't go the opposite, right? So, but we kept monetizing and maximizing that market that we were in.
Yeah.
The issue we had was we used to buy all of our deals at that time from wholesalers, agents, and our network.
Yeah.
Because, again, I hated wholesaling. Like, the marketing aspect, all that stuff, it was hard for me. You know, I'm good with sellers, but the marketing I just wasn't clicking with. Mm-hmm. I wasn't understanding. We kept doing a bunch of random lists. It was a lot of overhead.
Yeah.
A lot of work, a lot of everything. So I didn't like doing that, but in 2020, our wholesalers and agents, they stopped bringing us deals because we were being outbid by literally everybody that was moving from California and all these places. They were paying cash and like 50 grand over ask. Mm-hmm. So we were losing out on every deal. So we had to go back to marketing.
Yeah.
And I think that was a saving grace for us. It forced us back into marketing, into generating our own deals.
Yeah.
And it forced me into looking at wholesaling in a whole different way.
Yeah.
Which is how to build an acquisition business and not a wholesale company.
Love it.
You know, because the wholesale company is what I hated.
Mm-hmm.
The acquisition business, on the other hand, that's a lot more attractive.
Yeah.
So that's where we made that shift.
Very cool. So you made that shift, build the acquisition business, and maybe just talk a little bit about your main strategies now and what your acquisition business looks like.
So right now, our strategy is focus, right? We pick a strategy that we're really good at this moment is foreclosures. And we go all in on learning everything we possibly can about the foreclosure process, people in foreclosure, options when people are in foreclosure. So right now what we do is we pull the list directly from the county. And what that does for us is that as soon as the county posts a property for sale, we're the first to call it. So we're the first people to make contact with these sellers. And we're already offering them help. Like, hey, you know, everybody calls a foreclosure and the first thing they say is like, hey, I wanted to see if you wanted to sell your house at blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
They're in foreclosure for a reason. They don't want to sell their house. You asking them if they want to sell their house causes them to hang up on you, right? So I'm cool. Keep doing that because for us, what we do is like, hey, I've noticed that your house on Cliffside is set to be auctioned off on May 5th. Are you still looking for ways to save your home and stop that foreclosure?
Yeah.
Everybody says yes.
Yeah.
Because, of course, they want to save their house. Yeah. They're like, yeah, how can you help me? So now we are able to expand and start digging deeper into what caused that foreclosure, why are they there, why they fall behind, and all of a sudden we're able to negotiate really good, steep deals.
Yeah.
But the benefit that came out of that is we hired a coach a few years ago, and he taught us a strategy of buying people's interest in deals. So what we learned is there's so many people in foreclosure that inherited the house. So they don't have any financial stake in the property. They don't really care what happens. It's not like their credit's gonna get destroyed. So what we do is we're like, hey, we see you have this house, you have all these heirs. If I was to give you a couple $1,000, would you sign your interest over to us so we can resolve all these problems?
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh yeah, sure, because I was just gonna let it go to foreclosure. So you can buy a house for a couple $1,000s now and you own a house that's worth $80,000-$90,000. Right? There's still some title issue. There's some things that need to get cleared up. There's risks that we're taking, but it's very calculated risk, right? Mm-hmm. So we, instead of needing to do 10, 15 deals a month, we can do 3 to 4 and still hit over 100, 150 grand a month. And our overhead is very small compared to what it used to be.
Yeah. So are you guys doing any fix and flips now or wholesale only?
Yeah, now the fix and flip, the good thing with generating your own deals is you get to cherry pick them.
Yeah.
So we don't do any massive renovations anymore. I mean, before our smallest renovation was like 70 grand. Now our largest renovation, I think, is like maybe 60.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're quick in and out deals, like cosmetic. So we don't have to struggle with finding contractors with the high skill labor or anything. It's quick in and out deals and they make, you know, good margins on them. So it's a nice little balance between both fix and flips and wholesales.
Yeah. So you got super good, super niche down at mm-hmm. acquisitions and just wholesaling in general. And then you decided to start teaching other people how to do it, yeah. right?
Yeah.
Tell us about that journey and you know what your coaching business is right now.
So I actually got bored with real estate.
Yeah.
So
I remember those combos.
Yeah. I got to a point where I started getting fried. I've done a lot of deals. I've done hundreds of flips. I've done thousands of different transactions. I've spoken to every kind of seller, seen every type of home. Like, it just, I lost the attraction to real estate. I lost the passion for it.
Yeah, a little burnt out probably.
Yeah. Very burnt out. I mean, like I said, it's been years of just grinding and struggling and not knowing, are we going to make it this month, you know? And we finally got to a place where it's like, all right, we're comfortable. And I realized that it's like, I just don't care.
Yeah.
Like, I lost interest. And at the time, I was with Mike Kiko, and he was like, you're a coach. And I was like, but I don't want to be one of these gurus.
Yeah.
You know, I was pissed because I would look at these gurus that's just like pushing product.
Yeah.
Right? And I was like, I want to actually help people. I don't want to just push product. I want to get people to be successful. He's like, so be a coach. He's like, don't be one of them. And I was like, all right. So I just put out there, I was like, hey, I'm looking for some students that want to learn how to like build acquisitions. And man, the amount of people that started responding blew my mind.
Yeah.
And I started getting into it and I started enjoying it. And I was like, but I need a framework to teach them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the Prime Wholesaling Method came out, because I started reverse engineering all the things that we did. And I started teaching it to a few students, refining it, teaching it to other ones, mm-hmm. refining it. And now I got it locked down to a nice little, like, clean, nice nine-pillar system.
Yeah.
That's like, it's structured, follow these steps, and you'll make money.
That's awesome.
You know, and it's been working great. It's been, more than anything, it's been fulfilling.
Yeah.
You know, it's been something that John the other day comes, he's like, yo, we just made like 90 grand on this deal in like less than 30 days. I'm like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
A student calls me, hey, I just made 40. I'm like, awesome. Yeah. That's amazing. I'm so happy. You know, it just, it excites me more that they're succeeding than
doing a deal yourself these days.
Yeah, I just don't care.
Yeah, very cool. So your main avatar for a student is probably in the beginner stages of their wholesaling journey, would you say?
So actually, no, I don't really target wholesalers. I target more fix and flippers and buy and hold investors that need to generate their own deals.
Okay, perfect.
So the majority of people I come across, it's who I was, right?
Yeah.
I was a flipper, I was a buy and hold investor. That, you know, I didn't have margin in my deals. Mm-hmm. It was difficult to generate my own deals. And that's who we target. We target those people that they want to flip houses, they want to buy rentals, but they can't cash flow, right? Or they can't acquire too many. Or one of my newest students, he's like, yeah, I made money on my last one, but lost money on the last two. And I was like, that's not good.
Yeah.
You know, losing money is it's a very rough business to
especially
be in.
Especially two out of three.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, that's very rough, you know, and
losing money happens, but maybe one out of 20.
Yeah. And the thing, what I see is like, they have all this hopes and dreams, and then they start losing too much money. And then they're like, ah, real estate sucks. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, it's not real estate. You were going about it the wrong way.
Yeah.
Right. So I do teach wholesalers as well. It's just that wholesalers, you know, like, they're like, how do I get to 10 deals a month? I'm like, that's the wrong question.
Yeah.
It's like, how much money do you want to make? You know, it's like, oh, I would love to make 20 grand. I was like, well, you don't need 10 deals a month to make 20 grand.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need one deal.
Yeah.
So right now the average is more or less like 40 to 60 grand a month is what they generate.
Yeah.
That's great. And that's like between two, maybe three deals a month.
So not necessarily wholesaling, but you're really coaching on, they're more beginners on the acquisitions and maybe the negotiation process.
Yes.
Yeah. So what are some of the, outside of the mindset that we already talked about, what are some of the obstacles or the main challenges you see that your students are having getting into the marketing or the acquisition and negotiating side?
They want to do the fun stuff only, right? So it's like, I just want to get the contracts. And I was like, but do you know how to talk to a seller? No.
Yeah.
I want to do a flip, but do you know how to analyze a deal? No. And I'm like, the success happens in the boring work.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants to do it. You understand? So what I teach them is, like, in the framework, I teach them how to pull data, how to analyze their market, how to do all these things. And they're like, I don't like doing that. I'm like, I didn't ask.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's one of these things that's like, it's just a part of success. That when you started your business, when I started my business, it's like, we were doing accounting. You know, we were doing everything. You had all the hats.
Yep.
You know, and most of those things sucked. Like, if I could do one thing, was just go to seller appointments. That was the only thing I wanted to do, is seller appointments. It's the only thing I liked. I spent so much time doing Excel spreadsheets.
Yeah.
The opposite of seller appointments. Yep. You know, and it's like, but you got to do it.
Yeah.
And that's why whenever I vet somebody to be in the mastermind, I test, like, how dedicated they are. Because then what I hate to hear is, like, oh, this is not working. No, you're not working.
Yeah.
You're not willing to do the boring stuff. And I get it. It's boring. But it's going to be very fun after a year or two when it's like, you don't have to worry about where your deals come from.
Yeah.
Because you're always consistently generating deals. And they're consistently high margin deals.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, now you love your life. Right. I have a student that... He was at the event last night, and he was saying, it's been the last 4 months. He's like, we've made revenue every single month. He's like, it's never been that way. And I was like, how does it feel? He's like, feels great.
Yeah.
I was like, you got past the sucky part, but now you make money consistently.
Yeah.
You understand?
It's that, like, helps grease the wheels for sure. Yeah.
And to me, though, I had a young guy yesterday ask me that question. I was like, he's like, how can I compete with all the people in the market? I was like, you will outlast them. That's how you compete.
Yeah.
I was like, people don't stick around.
Yeah.
If you come to your networking event, you come every single month, you're going to see very few people that show up consistently.
Yeah.
Everybody else is new faces.
Yeah. 50 people drop out, 50 new people every month.
Every month. Always new faces.
But the middle kind of stays. And those are the ones that are successful.
And it's not a surprise, no. Right? It's like those people that you see consistently are the ones that are always succeeding. I was like, you gotta outlast everybody. And the only way to do this, do the things nobody wants to do. Do the market research. Understand your market. Understand the marketing. Focus. I know focus sucks for so many people because it's not fun. It's like, I wanna do this market. It's cool to go to a networking event and says, like, you know, what do you do for marketing? Well, I do everything. To me, that's not sexy because I bet you're not making money.
You're probably not good at any of those.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm more impressed when somebody says, I focus on this one thing.
Yeah, and I'm great at that.
Yeah. And I was like, you're probably killing it. They're like, yes, I am.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. I've met people back in San Antonio that they have 6 people on their team. There are multiple markets and they can't even pay themselves.
Right.
And I was like, this is ridiculous, man. My goal is, like, one investor by yourself, you should be at about, right now on average, between $300,000 and $400,000 a year, one investor. You bring on another investor, you should be at least doubling that income, right? With a VA, you can get to about $500,000 to about $600,000 a year, just by yourself.
Yeah.
Why are you building a team?
Yeah.
You know, you have a team and you're barely able to cross $200,000 a year. Like, that's insane to me.
Right.
But at the same time, I made the same mistake.
Yeah, of course.
So,
there's a balance there for sure. Yeah. And there's a difference between, you know, being financially independent and wanting to be a solopreneur, make your own hours, all of that versus, hey, I want a business out of this and build a team. And those are things you got to think about too. Like, as you don't have to think about it day one, you know, start off on your own no matter what. You can't start off with a team, but those are the type of decisions you got to make and what that looks like. Because when you do bring on a team, you get to be in your genius zone a little bit, but you're going to have to sacrifice some of that margin of the business, no doubt.
100%. Well, and it's even when I talk to people and they're like, my goal is to acquire rentals and they have a great job. And I'm like, don't quit. Keep your job and acquire rentals. I was like, you're already halfway there.
Yeah.
I was like, you have steady income. You probably have great credit. You have W-2. You'll qualify for loans. You understand? I was like, just take... Be patient, acquire a rental at a time.
Yep.
I was like, it'll build faster than you think.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks that doing it that way is gonna take for fucking ever to build a rental portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
It's like your first property takes forever.
Yeah.
The second one is fast, the third one even faster. You could be at 10 properties in in a matter of a year or so.
Yeah, we did a little skit or a little theoretical path towards financial freedom, or no, path to being a millionaire in 5 years.
Okay.
And it was all about acquiring real estate, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's similar to our journey, in that, like, hey, the first year, like, we didn't even buy a deal. We just learned and figured out what the hell we wanted to do. Yeah. Like, don't even buy one the first year. Just figure things out. And hopefully which is possible, but we didn't, and you don't need to. And then the next year, this is 5 years, millionaire in 5 years. Year two, only one deal.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, year three, maybe another two, three. But then after that, it just starts clicking and compounding and systemizing. But that have to start with that one. And it's the hardest one by far.
And what I love about that is, like, if somebody comes to me and they tell me, look, I don't plan on buying a house for the next 2 years. I just want to learn. I'm like, dude, you're going to kill it.
Yeah.
You're going to fucking kill it because you're coming in with the right mindset. Mm-hmm. And it's not even that you won't get a house in that first year or so. It's that you already have the mindset that's like, I'm here to build something.
Yeah.
Right? And that mindset of just, you know, I'm going to take my time. I'm going to build it right. I want to get to know this. I want to learn that. It's like, man, you'll build a portfolio in no time, and it's going to be a killer portfolio when you're done. But it's that when you're saying that, I could imagine people listening and being like, oh, hell no, I want one right now.
Exactly.
And I'm like, and that's
they
why
you think
you're
5 years is too long, and you look back after 5 years, you're like, that went by in a flash.
Exactly. The 5 years are going to go by either way.
Yeah.
Are you going to be a millionaire when that happens?
Yep.
That's the question, right? Yep. So it's like, if the 5 years are going to go by either way, and I can promise you in 5 years you're going to be a millionaire, would you do the work? You know, and everybody says yes, but when it comes time to it, they're like, I want it now.
Yep.
I want it now. I'm like, so you're sacrificing your 5 years for today.
Yep.
That's exactly what it is.
That's it. Every time. Switching gears a little bit. Let's talk about how coming to the United States as an undocumented immigrant, how that shaped your life and who you are today, and maybe even how that translated into your real estate investing journey.
Well, I mean, it's obviously affected every aspect of my life. Most recently, I made the decision to move from Texas to Tennessee at the end of May. I'm going to be moving there.
Congrats, bro.
Yeah, and it's something I've wanted to do.
You'll be closer, right?
Oh, yeah. I think we're like 7 hours away.
That's not bad.
Yeah, I already have road trips planned to come up here. But when I made that decision, people asked me, like, why are you moving to Tennessee? Honestly, because I can.
Yeah.
Like, and not to be like an asshole about it. It's just like, I've never made a move that wasn't out of necessity. Every move in my life has been for survival.
Yeah.
This is the first time I'm making a move because I was like, I want to be in the mountains.
Yeah.
And I can do this. And just that alone messed with me recently. Because I still, up until now, I still see myself as an undocumented immigrant, you know? So I'm like,
it's like an identity almost. Yeah.
I don't deserve these things.
Wow. Yeah.
I don't deserve what I've accomplished. Mm-hmm. You know, when people come up to me and they're like, oh yeah, I would love to hire you and all this. I'm like, who am I for you to believe in? You know what I mean? Like, I have those doubts, and it comes from all of that, because when I dropped out of high school, my guidance counselor, because you got to see your guidance counselor, when I told her I was dropping out, she's like, yeah, it makes sense.
Dude, thanks for the support.
You know how encouraging this shit is? You know, so
good luck.
Like, she's like, yeah, it makes sense.
I was
like,
you probably should.
I was like, all right, well, fuck you too.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was.
You're one a little pushback.
Something like, no, you can make it. Yeah. You know, it's like nothing.
Oh, man.
And my dad was like, we are born to work until we die. My brother, when I started like reading books and try to learn all this, he's like, oh, you really think you're going to get rich from reading a book? You know, you're just being lazy. So I had my family against me.
Yeah.
Every step of the way, you know, because that's not what immigrants do.
Yeah.
Immigrants put their head down we work.
Yep.
And we work hard. We work till like our hands are bleeding. I was 20 years old with 3 herniated discs, arthritis in both my wrists, arthritis in both my knees because of how hard I worked.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that was acceptable. But yet me wanting to do something better was like, no, that's not what we do. So now that I am doing something better, it's something that's like, it's so uncomfortable because I am comfortable. I'm not in survival mode. My family's fine. we're doing great. I don't need for anything. You know what I mean? Like, I literally just took a few days to fly up here and hang out with you guys. Like, there's nothing, you know, and it's like, it's fine. Nothing fell apart, right? And till this day, my dad still never said, like, I'm proud of what you've done.
Yeah.
Because it's not in his mindset, you know, to be like, what I did was okay.
Yeah.
Because you need to be working hard.
Is he still in New York?
No, he's in Texas.
Okay.
But he's busting his ass.
Yeah.
He's killing himself working.
He will, man.
Yeah.
He will.
I mean,
he is proud of you. I guarantee it.
I'm sure he is, right? I'm sure he is. But it's the mindset.
Yeah.
You know, and how that shaped me too is it's made me an amazing father.
Yeah.
I truly believe that I'm a great father because I look at my son and I'm like, the world is yours.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm never going to shoot you down.
Yeah.
Whatever you want to do, the world is yours.
Yeah.
You know, I felt it from people when they saw me in New York. They're like, oh, look, another white boy. This is cool. Then they hear me speak Spanish, and they're like, you're one of those. And instantly, I was, like, you know, sidelined and pushed out. And I used to play soccer when I was a kid. And the coach would bench me because I would speak Spanish to the Colombians and Hondurans that were on the team that didn't speak English. I'm like, how do you want me to communicate with them? Sign language?
Right.
Like, they speak Spanish. I speak Spanish.
This is a good thing.
Yeah, but he always felt like we were talking bad about him. So he would bench me, you know? So it was always like, and funny story is that about 2 years ago, I was at the playground with my kids. At home, we speak Spanish to our kids. They know Spanish first. We're at the playground, and I'm talking to my kid in English because I'm ashamed to speak in Spanish in public. I never realized that until that moment because my son looks at me like, what the fuck are you saying?
What's wrong with you, Dad?
He's like, I don't understand your words. And I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Like, I'm ashamed to speak Spanish in public.
Yeah.
Because I've been criticized so much for it because it's like, if I was dark-skinned, it probably would have been acceptable.
Right.
But because I'm white, it's like, why are you speaking Spanish? This isn't normal. You know, so that whole thing has made me more, you know, it made me struggle a little bit, but it also made me kind of like, I'm going to prove all of you wrong.
Yeah.
You know, it put a tremendous chip on my shoulder.
I love that.
Yeah, so it was one of those things that, like, whenever somebody be like, oh, that can't be done, I was like, oh, just watch me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you're going to learn. And it also, the things that we've talked with Mike Kitko a lot about was, like, because of that, I felt like I needed to make everything I did hard.
Yeah.
Because I needed to be, like, the barbarian,
right?
Yeah. I needed to just be like,
he still comes out.
Yeah. And he does, but it needs to be controlled.
Yeah.
You know, it can't be at all times because it got to a point where I was having massive panic attacks, you know, anxiety and all these things because it was, you know, it's stressful to, like, be constantly at max.
Yep.
You know, so learning to control that and knowing that I have that power to, that it's like that worthiness that I belong where I am.
Yeah.
You know, I deserve to be here. I deserve to have what I have.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like that's been, it's been hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a journey.
Well, super cool, man. I mean, that power is there for sure. And learning to control it's probably your superpower. So, man. So
yeah.
Never doubt yourself, bro. Man, you're a powerful dude.
Yeah. And,
super
and,
cool.
And even when people tell me that, I'm like, instantly, I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know, but it's,
if you
it's,
only knew me.
Yeah. If you only knew, yeah. You know, all the insecurities.
Yeah.
But that's what, you know, being illegal is, it's rough. It's, my mom always used to joke that she said, I'm going to sue this country for psychological abuse.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you're illegal, it's like you're always, like, I didn't grow up as a traditional, like, a lot of people, you hear their journeys, and they were, like, entrepreneurs when they were in kindergarten, right? Selling lollipops at the playground. Like, my whole journey in school and everything was hoping I would not get deported.
Mm.
I wouldn't go on school
just
trips.
Just living with that fear.
Always.
Yeah.
I would go on school trips. Like, I wouldn't go on a lot of school trips because my mom was worried that if we went somewhere, there was going to be immigration and they were going to catch me.
Yeah.
And that's not how life is.
Yeah.
But we didn't know any better. So everything we did was out of fear.
Yeah.
Was like, you know, you stayed quiet. You didn't make noise. You didn't stir anything up, you know, because if they catch you, you're gone.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, we didn't want to get deported.
Yeah.
I didn't want my family to get deported.
Mm.
So it's like everything, even now, I've been a U.S. citizen now for, I want to say, about like 5 years.
Nice, man. Cool. Good for you.
Yeah. So I'm very, very proud of that. Yeah. And I still drive like an illegal immigrant, mm-hmm. because when I drive, I'm always looking for cops.
Yeah, well, and I'm always me too. Scared. I'm bored here.
But I'm still driving with the fear now of getting a ticket.
Yeah.
I'm driving with the fear of like not being here anymore. Right. Right. Yeah. And it's like, well, they really, that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
But it's always inside of me.
For
every
sure.
Every time I, even when I fly, sometimes I'm going through TSA and I'm like,
they're gonna catch me. Yeah.
And it's like, dude, you're legal. Relax.
Yeah. Yeah. Wild, man. Well, yeah. Super cool that you're able to move your family into the mountains, based off a desire and not necessity. So super proud of you for that. It's amazing, man. What's another thing that you could call a bucket list, you call whatever you want, just something that you want and don't necessarily need to do or experience or buy, whatever it is, something on your bucket list that you hope and want to accomplish the next few years?
A bucket list. I mean, the only thing that comes to mind is I've promised Val a trip to Italy.
Oh, yeah.
And I know I'm going to give it to her. It's coming. We grew up in New York around a lot of Italians, around a lot of Italian food, the culture. In Argentina, like, my whole family is pretty much from Italian descent, mm-hmm. right? So we grew up around all of that kind of background, and it's like, we would love to go spend, I don't know, 2-3 weeks in Italy.
That'd be amazing.
You know, yeah. So that's definitely a bucket list item, and it's front of mind.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm nailing things in, and I'm like, as soon as it opens, I'm in.
Yeah, well, Tennessee's a little closer.
It's a lot. Yeah. So we're moving in the right direction.
For sure, man. All right, another fun question here. So you're hosting a dinner, you know, catered in by the best food you can think of, and you can have three people at that dinner with you, whether you know them or don't know them, alive or dead. Which three people would you choose?
Three people. I would love to sit down with George Washington.
Yeah.
Somebody that not only won the Revolutionary War, right, was the general, everything fell on his shoulders. But after that, they came to him and they're like, we want you to lead the country now.
Yeah.
It's like, really? Like, and I think he actually says it, like, have I not done enough? Right? That burden.
Yeah.
Because, and obviously I'm not comparing myself to George Washington. It's just that, like, in my family ecosystem, it's people always look towards me to, like, what am I going to do and how are they going to follow suit, right?
You're a leader.
Yeah. And it's like, so, and even in the business and everything, and then in the community, and sometimes it's like, it's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
You know, you got to think about your actions a little bit more. You got to think about your reactions. You know, you got to think about the decisions you make. And George Washington, like, when I think back, I've always loved the story. And I was like, that'd be a cool guy to sit down and, like, have a conversation with.
Love it, man. So you got GW there. Who else?
Okay. Man, this is a tough one.
Yeah.
So I would say Tony Robbins.
Yeah. Great one.
He's just a powerhouse. Yeah. I think he's an amazing person.
He is.
Definitely Tony Robbins. And I'm just alternating in my head. Marcus Aurelius.
Nice.
Yeah, Marcus. I've been reading his book, Meditations, and it's the same thing, like, his coming up, his, you know, his whole mindset of having. So I guess, I don't know if it's ego or what, but, like, I feel like I was brought to this earth to do something so much greater. And it's like, how do you handle that?
Yeah.
You know, how do you, because even I'm struggling just handling the fact that I'm moving to Tennessee, and I should be proud of that. And it's like, that's a struggle. So it's like, I want more. You know, I want to reach higher goals. So it's like, what does that look like?
Yeah, super cool. Well, that's a powerhouse dinner. Yeah. What type of food are you eating at that dinner?
Definitely Italian.
Italian. Oh, I love Italian food.
Yeah.
Like authentic, like from Italy.
Oh, yeah. Fresh made pasta. Yeah.
Maybe this dinner's in Italy.
So. Oh, yeah.
All right, very cool. All right, before we kind of begin the wrap up here, let's get into some over under. You guys good with that? All right, so over under is a segment here. And, three questions, over under, all right? First question, and we both try to guess this, right? In the course of a lifetime, the average person will walk around the world 4 times, over or under?
I would say it's under.
I'm going to go over.
Over.
Over. What we got here, guys? 5 plus. Handle the widest circumference, too, of the of the Earth. That's amazing.
I'm surprised.
10,000 steps a day, baby. Yeah. Got my Fitbit on. Barely counting those steps.
Walking around the world.
Yeah. Movement is lotion. You ever heard of that?
No.
Me neither. I don't know where that came from.
That sounds weird.
All right. Second question. Over under. Giraffes, you know, they're tall, are 25 times more likely than humans to be struck by lightning.
Nah, I call bullshit.
Me too. Under. 30 times.
What?
Man, they're just out there getting zapped.
Imagine a giraffe getting zapped.
Oh, that'd be awful.
There's got to be a YouTube video on a giraffe getting zapped by lightning.
If we find that, let's please play. But think about the chances of humans getting struck by lightning, the lowest, how low that percentage is. So we're still talking like fractions of a fraction of a percent.
That's so insane.
Yeah, still insane. If we can get a video on that, it might not be appropriate, but I still kind of want to see it. All right. Over under. A chicken can live for 19 months without its head.
No.
It has to be under. To be under. What is that?
18 months.
Wow. One chicken lived for a year and a half with no head? I guess where that saying running around like a chicken with his head cut off comes from. Because they're going to run around for years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, a funny story with that. In Argentina, my grandparents had a chicken coop. And they kill their own chickens and prep them and everything. They gave it to my dad to kill a chicken. And what they do is they just... They grab the neck, twist, and pop.
Oh, my God. Bare hands?
That's it. That's how they do it.
That would give me the heebies.
Oh, dude, it's disgusting. And my dad, he's being father of the barbarian, he twists, pops, and the head is in his hand.
Oh.
And then he, freaks out, drops the chicken. The chicken just takes off. And it's, squirting blood just running through the whole house.
That is traumatic.
It's that is just terrible.
I would have dreams about that or nightmares for my entire life.
It was pretty crazy. Just blood just spewing out and the chicken just freaking running with no head. I'm not eating that.
No, that's still alive.
Yeah, no.
did you have chickens for the eggs as well too?
Yeah, over there in Argentina everything's natural, right? So everybody has their little garden, their chickens, their pigs, everything is fresh killed.
That's awesome. Well, are there cows? There's a milk cow and a meat cow, right? Mm-hmm. They're different, I think. Is it the same thing with chicken, eggs versus meat?
Yeah. they had their, there were these bigger chickens that they were the ones that they used for eggs that were always popping out eggs. And then they had these leaner ones that they just raised for food.
Yeah, steroids and no steroids.
No, all natural.
Yeah, well, come up here.
The chicken over there, they're actually, when you see a chicken, not alive, right? Feathers plucked and everything. They're yellow. The chickens here are white.
Oh, okay.
You know, over there they're yellow because that's what a chicken actually is supposed to look like.
Yeah.
And they're much smaller than these half
juiced
a turkey's
up
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's and they're delicious.
Yeah.
But not when you see them running without a head. That was just.
Yeah. I mean, think about all the chicken we've eaten. So it was probably one of those chickens that are running around.
Probably for 18 months.
Oh,
no
gosh,
head.
I'm going to go without chicken for a while, I think. Except for those dino nuggets my 7-year-olds eat. Those are fire. those are probably the not real ones if I had
it. I'm pretty sure it's maybe some percentage of chicken in there.
Yeah, for sure. Well, John, man, this was fun. Did you enjoy yourself?
I had a blast.
Yeah, thanks for sharing your story. It's a powerful one, and super excited about your business and your move.
I appreciate it, man.
For you, brother. Appreciate everybody watching. Hope you guys had a good time. We'll see you on the next one.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. We hope you got some major value from our conversation. If you love what you learn, make sure you like, rate, review the show, and help us spread the word by telling a friend.
If you'd like to learn more about working with me inside one of my programs, we'll have those links in the show notes, along with all our social media handles, so you connect with us there for free. If there's a real estate question you'd like us to answer, feel free to send us a message, and we'll cover it in an upcoming show.